Some of you, I don't know, may have heard this already by email, or perhaps they announced it at breakfast. Freddie is sick today, so I'm going to give two lectures. I'm going to take his time slot, and both quantum information lectures, of course, not trying to substitute in string theory. And then assuming he's feeling better tomorrow, we'll have no quantum information class tomorrow, and Freddie will give two lectures. But obviously, this plan for tomorrow, at least, will be subject to change, depending on whether he's feeling better or not. So I guess you'll have to get up enough, at least, to check your email or something to find out what's going on. So today we'll talk about quantum error correction, again, and fault tolerance in the first lecture. In the second lecture, I'll do quantum key distribution. So I guess we can get started with the regular lecture, as usual, by asking if there's questions on what's been going on so far. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, because in many popular science books and magazines, they would say that a quantum computer knows the answer before you ask the question. So does it just refer to the principle of superposition or something?
Knows the answer before you ask the question. I'm really not sure what that's referring to. I don't know. That seems like a particularly bad description. So one thing you will find in a lot of popular descriptions of quantum computing is the idea that a quantum computer is like a really big parallel computer and is doing lots of computations at once, which to a certain extent is true. But of course, as you've seen from the algorithm side, that's not enough, right? Because if you just make a superposition, sure, you can do a lot of computations at once, but then when you measure, you'll just get one at random, right? And so kind of a naive application of this idea where you can do all sorts of computations at the same time would suggest you can do like Grover search in constant time, right? Because you try everything and then you only pick out the answer that works. But of course that doesn't actually function. So I can only guess that maybe that's kind of some version of what they're saying, that somehow being able to do all the computations at once means it knows the answer. But in any case, it's not, neither one is really a great description of what's going on. But hopefully you've been gathering a better idea. I mean, it's the exact nature of the power of what a quantum computer can do that a fast computer cannot do is something that people are still kind of grappling with. And I mean, while we've developed some intuition as to what problems quantum computers are good at, what problems they're not good at, I don't think it's really a very reliable intuition at this point, which is why it's still an interesting research topic. Okay, any other questions? Okay, since we have a few more people here now, maybe I'll repeat the announcement, which is Freddie is sick. So I will be giving two lectures today on quantum information. Then, assuming he's feeling better tomorrow, he will give two lectures tomorrow. So you'll have to check your email or something to find out what's going on tomorrow, I guess. Okay, so are there any other questions? No, okay. So then let's go back to quantum error correcting codes. So yesterday I showed you the 9-qubit code and argued that it could correct one general single qubit error. So here's the 9-qubit code. Remember, it encodes the 0 as 3 copies of 000 plus 111, and the 1 as 3 copies of 000 minus 111. Okay? And remember, and of course, the superposition alpha 0 plus beta 1 is alpha times this thing plus beta times this thing, right? What I'd like to do today is kind of analyze a little more detail what you have to do for this 9-qubit code to measure the error syndrome, not in 100% detail, but a bit more than we talked about yesterday, and then use that to generalize this 9-qubit code and come up with a structure and a formalism for talking about other quantum error correcting codes. So, okay. So what do we measure to figure out where the errors are in this 9-qubit code? Well, the first thing we want to do is we want to find the bit flip errors, right? And to do that, we're going to look at each set of 3 qubits. And remember, we want to figure out whether one of those 3 is different from the other 2. And as before, we're doing that by looking at the first 2 qubits and seeing if they're the same or different. And the second 2 qubits in the single set of 3 and seeing whether they're the same or different. Okay? So I drew a little circuit for the repetition code that showed you how to do that, right? We do some controlled NOT gates. But what I'd like to do today is rephrase that without a circuit, but instead saying what operators we want to measure. And in this case, we can do it as poly operators. So in particular, the first 2 qubits, if we want to measure whether they're the same or different, we can look at the eigenvalue of this operator, z tensor z. Why is that? Well, again, same kind of analysis. If they're both 0, we get +1 squared as the eigenvalue, so it's +1. If they're both 1, we get -1 squared. So again, an eigenvalue +1. So if they're the same, we have eigenvalue +1. If they're different, we have 1, 0, and 1, 1. So the eigenvalue is +1 times -1, or -1. Okay? So same eigenvalue +1, different eigenvalue -1. So measuring this is the same as what that first ancilla qubit did yesterday, right? It's measuring whether these two things are the same or different. Okay? And then to measure whether the second and third qubits are the same or different, well, we want to do the same thing. We want to do z tensor z on the second and third qubits and measure the eigenvalue of that. Okay? And then we have to do this for each set of 3. So that's going to give us 4 more operators. And of course, each of these operators is really, you know, should be acting on 9 qubits. So it could be z tensor I, you know, 7 i's. Okay, and this one should have 7 i's in everything but the second and third place, and so on. But I'm saving space and making it a little cleaner to look at by not putting in those i's in this case. Okay? So each row is going to be a different operator that we have to measure to find part of the bit flip error syndrome for this 9-qubit code. So the next thing we have to do is look at the phase error syndrome. Right? In the phase error syndrome, you remember we want to see whether the phases in these 3 sets of 3 are the same or different. Right? Whether we have +++ or -++. And actually, we don't want to know which one of those 2 we have. We just want to know whether we have all 3 the same or we have one that's different, like +/-+ or -++. Okay? So we're going to use kind of the same principle, except now we don't want to measure the eigenvalue of a ZZ operator. We want to measure the eigenvalue of X's somehow, right? Because we're measuring a phase error rather than a bit flip error. So this 0, 0, 0, +1, 1, 1, it's just, you know, X. So the first thing you might try is like X1, X4, right? But that's not going to work. This is not even an eigenvector of X1, X4. With any eigenvalue, right? Because if you flip just x1, you'll get, for instance, 1, 0, 0, +0, 1, 1. And if you flip x4, you'll get another factor of that. And that's not right. That's not proportional to the original. So instead, in order to get an eigenvector, what we have to do is we have to flip all 3 qubits in one of these sets of 3. Okay? So for instance, if we do xxx on the first 3 qubits, that'll take 0, 0, 0, +1, 1, 1 to itself, right? But 0, 0, 0, -1, 1, 1 will go to minus itself. So this operator by itself is no good. It's not telling us what we want to know. Instead, it's telling us something about the difference between the logical 0 and the logical 1. We don't want to measure that, right? That tells us something that would destroy the superposition if we found it out. Okay? But it's giving us a hint as to what to do, which is this thing has eigenvalue +1 for xxx. This thing has eigenvalue -1. And if we look at xxx on the second set of 3, it's also telling us +1 for this one and -1 for this one. So if we look at the the tensor product of six x's on the first six qubits, then this will have eigenvalue plus 1 squared. This one will have eigenvalue minus 1 squared. So they are both plus 1 eigenvectors of this operator. And if one of the phases is different, if we have plus minus or minus plus, then we'll get an eigenvalue of minus 1 here. Right? So measuring this will tell us exactly what we want to know, whether the first two phases are the same or different. And then we want to measure whether the second and third phases are the same or different. So we should do the same thing on the last six qubits. Okay? And so putting this all together, we get a total of eight operators we have to measure to find the error syndrome for this nine-qubit code. Okay? Any questions so far? Yeah.
When you place with error, if you start with this position of 0, like plus 1, like you're faced with protections, like you encode 0 and 1 as one of that superpositions, but it only prevents errors in that superposition, not in the initial one, right?
Yeah, so look, so. Okay, so we have to distinguish some separate things. So the idea is, so remember, we're still dealing with the quantum error correcting code scenario where all the operations are perfect, and we only have to worry about errors once we've encoded and sent it through, and we're sending it through the channel. And so you want to distinguish between kind of a logical phase flip or bit flip, which happens on the qubit, say, before it's encoded, and changes the value of data, and a physical bit flip or phase flip or other kind of error that acts on one of these nine physical qubits. Okay, so if you have a phase flip that acts on one of the nine physical qubits, the point of doing this encoding is that we can figure that out and correct it and get back to the original state. Obviously, if you have something that acts just on the logical qubit, we have no way of figuring out that anything is wrong because, I mean, you know, if 0 plus 1 was encoded as one thing, 0 minus 1 will be encoded as something else, but we don't know that it was originally 0 plus 1 and not 0 minus 1. Right? So there's no way, if there's a logical bit flip, if we ever get back to a valid code word, there's no way to tell that that's actually an error. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So we had the eight things that we measure to find the error syndrome of this nine-qubit code. But of course, this is not really unique, right? I said we'll measure whether the first two qubits are the same or different and the second and third qubits are the same or different. But of course, you could have done it a different way. You could have said, oh, I want to measure whether the first and third qubits are the same or different. That's not independent, of course. If the first two are the same and the second two are the same, then the first and third have to be the same. But you could have measured, instead of the second and third, you could have measured the first and third, just substituted it, and that would have worked just as well. So there's lots of other things you could measure. And so if you think about it, the way we've defined these operators that tell us the error syndrome are, they all have the property that m psi is equal to psi for all code words psi. We've defined them so that the code words are all plus one eigenstates of all of these eight operators. Okay, and so if we have two things, m and n, for which this is true, then it's certainly also true that m times n psi is equal to psi, because m times n psi is equal, n psi is equal to psi, so m, that's, this is equal to m psi, which is again equal to psi. Okay? So if we have two of these error syndrome operators and we take the product, it has the same basic property, that all the code words are plus one eigenstate for the product. And so in fact, what we can do is we can define a whole group in the sense of group theory, of operators that act on this code and leave it invariant. So this is called the stabilizer. And it's defined as the set of poly operators. So this I'll use define in a second. Such that m psi is equal to psi for all code words psi. Okay? And what I've just shown you up here is that the stabilizer is a group. Okay? It's closed under multiplication. I guess I didn't show you that it's closed under inverses, but because we're restricting to poly operators, basically everything is pretty much its own inverse. Could be minus its own inverse, but in this case, plus. Okay? So let me define what I mean by P sub n. So the poly group, P sub n, is the group consisting of tensor products of I, X, Y, Z on n qubits. This is the n qubit poly group with overall phase plus or minus 1 or plus or minus I. Okay? So, we've already seen the poly operators showing up a lot yesterday, right? So we hadn't seen this yet, but it turns out that the things you want to measure for this 9-qubit code are all poly operators. We said that if you want to correct a single qubit error, it's enough to correct just any 1-qubit poly error, right? And if you want to correct a t-qubit error, it's enough to correct t-qubit poly errors. And this is not completely a coincidence. The poly group has a number of spectral properties that make it, for one thing, very, very useful for defining these stabilizers and understanding the properties of quantum error correcting codes, and possible to have this error correction property that correcting a poly error is good enough to correct any general error. So in particular, so P sub T, poly group on T qubits, spans the matrices on T qubits. So that's one useful property. And that's the property we needed, that correcting poly errors on T qubits was enough to correct general error on T qubits. So that's one property. The other properties that make the poly group nice for analyzing error correction are, it has a lot of nice algebraic properties. So in particular, if we have some operator in the poly group, then that means it either squares to 1 or it squares to minus 1. By 1, I mean the identity on n qubits. Okay? And the reason we can do that, can square to plus or minus 1, is because we have this I phase factor. And we need the I phase factor because y is I x times z. Right? So if you want it to be a group, it has to include all of these phases. So you can define it. You can define things slightly differently. Instead of y, you can use minus iy, which is just x times z. But then the i's will pop up in other weird places, and so kind of a trade-off of where you get these i's. This I think is probably the simplest. So this is one nice property, and this is why it's pretty much enough to look at the product to say that this is a group. Right? A group has to be closed under products and inverses. So what else? If you look at x, y, and z, any pair of them will anti-commute. Right? And if you look at this bigger group, P sub n on n qubits, that means that any two things in P sub n will either commute or anti-commute. Okay? And this is the really useful property that we're going to be using a lot. Okay? It's worth noting that, you know, for one qubit, the only things that will commute are trivial, right? Anything will commute with itself. Anything will commute with the identity. But x, y, and z, they all anti-commute with each other. But once you go to two qubits, you can have more interesting examples of things commuting. For instance, x tensor x commutes with z tensor z. Right? Because as you move x past z, you get a minus 1. As you move this x past this z, you get another minus 1. And so between two of them, you get minus 1 squared. Okay? So once you're dealing with n qubits, you have to be a little careful. But it's pretty straightforward, right? You just look, how many qubits do you have a different non-trivial poly? If that's even, then they commute. If it's odd, then they don't commute. They anti-commute. Okay? So more questions at this point? Yeah.
Just in those books that have those pairs of
this,
Z.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So which pairs do you measure with those Zs? Like 1, 2,
Right. So and it's maybe a little hard to see where the qubits go. But this is qubit 1 and 2.
Yeah.
So you measure the eigenvalue of ZZ on qubits 1 and 2. And you can use that using the same circuit we did before.
Yeah.
This is 2 and 3, 4 and 5 here, 5 and 6. 7, 8, 8, and 9. So the idea is I'm breaking it up into sets of 3, and I'm basically doing the repetition code on each set of 3. And then this is 6 x's on the first two sets of 3. This is on the second and third sets of 3.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So, so back to stabilizers then. So we saw that the stabilizer of a code, defined as a set of poly operators that leave the code words unchanged, has to be a group. And then for the 9-qubit code, these 8 poly operators generate the group. So that's not immediately obvious, but it turns out that every poly operator that has this property can be written as a product of these 8 things for the 9-qubit code. Okay, but you might ask, what other properties does this stabilizer group have? And if you think about it, you say, well, code words, we need them to be plus 1 eigenstates of all the operators in the group, right? And in general, if you have 2 operators that don't commute, they're not going to have simultaneous eigenstates at all. So that suggests that this group should be abelian. And in fact, that's the case, right? And that's pretty easy to prove. So if you have m and n in the stabilizer, so let's call this s, then that implies, well, mn psi is equal to psi, and nm psi is also equal to psi, right? So the difference, mn minus nm psi, which is the commutator acting on psi, that's equal to 0. While in general this doesn't necessarily imply that m and n commute, it just means that the commutator has some null subspace. In the case of poly operators, they either commute or anti-commute. And if they anti-commute, then the commutator will have full rank, so it won't have a null space. And so in this particular case, it implies that these things actually do commute. Okay? And so in particular, that says that the stabilizer is always in a abelian group. Okay? So far we've I I introduced this idea of a stabilizer by defining 9-qubit code yesterday and then figuring out what its stabilizer was today. But actually, it turns out, in general, to be better to go the other way, to come up with a stabilizer and then figure out the code from that. And the reason for that, well, there's a couple of reasons for that. So one is that, in general, the stabilizer is actually a more compact notation for describing the code. In this case, it's less compact, but once you get up to more encoded qubits, or just even more complicated codes, there's a substantial advantage for using the stabilizer. The other reason is that the stabilizer actually gives you some direct access to understand what types of errors are corrected. So I'll talk about that in a minute. But first, let's handle the very basic property. So let's write down, imagine writing down a stabilizer and coming up with a code. So what properties does that stabilizer have to have? Well, first of all, we know it has to be a group. And we know it has to be an abelian group. Okay? And if you think about it a little bit, there's one more condition that we have to add, which is that -1 is not in the stabilizer, right? Because if you define it this way, you'll never have minus the identity with a +1 eigenvalue, right? That's it, all its eigenvalues are -1. So let's suppose we have a subgroup of the polygroup So I guess subgroups, so I should really write it as less than or equal to. So S is an abelian group and minus the identity is not in S. Okay? Then S is a stabilizer for something and I can define the code space for this code to be the set of vectors psi such that m psi is equal to psi now for all m in S. Okay? So it's worth saying here that not every code, not every quantum error correcting code can be written this way. Okay? Only certain codes can be. The 9-qubit code is one. And a lot of other very commonly used codes can also be written this way. But you can come up with codes that can't be. It's just that stabilizer codes tend to be easier to work with. Yeah?
If you go out, why you are emphasizing the negative I shouldn't be in the...
Sorry, the negative, which?
The negative identity.
Oh, it's just a condition that you need. I don't really want to emphasize it. But if minus one is the stabilizer, and you try to define this, you'll find that there are no code words. Right, because minus I psi is never equal to psi. So that's all. And the reason I want there to be code words is I want there to be a code. But in particular, I want to have the following property. So the first thing you want to ask is how many code words you do have, right, when you define this. And it turns out that if the stabilizer S has R generators, then the dimension of the subspace, so R generators and, I guess, n physical qubits. On n physical qubits. I guess that was kind of implicit in the PN there, but I'll put it anyway. So then the dimension of T of S is 2 to the n minus r. So in other words, we have n minus r logical qubits. And frequently the number of logical qubits is written k. Just, you know, common letter to be used. Okay, and you can see this in action in the 9-qubit code, right? We had 9 physical qubits and 8 generators here. So we have 9 minus 8, or 1 encoded qubit. which is correct. So I'm not going to prove this. It uses a little bit of linear algebra, but it requires a kind of a different representation of these stabilizers that I'm not going to go into. But the intuition behind it, I think, is pretty easy, which is every time you add a generator, well, the generator is a Pauli operator. It has a plus one eigenspace and a minus one eigenspace. It divides the whole Hilbert space in half. Okay, so you start out, you have no generators. You have a Hilbert space of dimension 2 to the n. You add one generator, you divide it in half, so you have dimension 2 to the n minus 1. You add another generator, it divides it in half again. So you have 2 to the n minus 2. Every time you add a generator, you're dividing in half again. And so that's where you get this formula, 2 to the n minus r. The reason that's not a proof is because you have to show that actually you are dividing in half each time and that they're not, you know, intersecting in weird ways at strange angles. No. I mean, that is not sufficient. You need a bit more than that. I mean, it's easy to write down a bunch of operators that... so here's an easy example, right? So let's look at 4 by 4. So you have plus... actually, maybe 4 by 4 is not enough. I might have to go to 8 by 8. But suppose you have, you know, plus 1... There's two diagonal operators. You have plus 1 for the first 4 and minus 1 for the next 4. And then the second operator is plus 1 for 1, 2, and 3, and 5, right, and minus 1 for the others. Then the simultaneous subspace of those two is 1, 2, and 3. Okay. So, yeah, so it's definitely not enough that they commute. But these Pauli operators, yeah, they have actually a lot more properties than what I've just said here, but and so this is one of the nice ones too. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so let's see. So what should I do next? Right. Okay. Good. So then, of course, the most important property of a quantum error correcting code is how well it corrects errors. And I haven't talked much about that. But you maybe got a hint of it at the very start when we wrote down the stabilizer for the 9-qubit code. Because I wrote it down by saying, what do we need to measure to find the error syndrome? Okay? And in fact, in this 9-qubit code, each generator of the stabilizer corresponds to one bit for the error syndrome. Right, and putting together all the eigenvalues, you know, after there's been an error, all the eigenvalues of the stabilizer generators, that gives us the whole error syndrome. And in fact, that's generally true. Okay, so how does that work? Well, for the 9-qubit code, we use the Z operators to detect X errors and find out where they were. And we use the X operators to detect Z errors and find out where they were. And that's kind of the pattern that's going to hold true. You're using one kind of Pauli operator to detect errors of the other kind. So why is that? Well, let's imagine that we have some operator M in the stabilizer and some error in the Pauli group that anti-commutes with M. Okay? Well, let's look at the eigenvalue of E psi for M. So we'll apply M to E psi. And E and M anti-commute, so this is minus EM psi. And m psi, of course, is equal to psi, so this is minus e psi. Okay, so e psi has eigenvalue minus 1, where psi had eigenvalue plus 1. So e changes the plus 1 eigenvector to a minus 1 eigenvector. So So this is starting to tell us why this is a good thing to do, because the valid code words had eigenvalue plus 1, whereas some of the errors will change the eigenvalues to minus 1. Right? So if we see an eigenvalue minus 1, that's a sign that something's wrong. And more than that, it will tell us that it's something that anti-commuted with that particular operator. Okay? So on the other side, suppose we have E and M that commute. Okay, again, M is in the stabilizer and E is some other poly. Well, in that case, M E psi is equal to E M psi, and M psi is equal to psi again, so we have E psi. So it stays as a plus 1 eigenvalue. Okay, as you would expect, because they commute, the doing something with E is not going to disturb the eigenvalue of M. Okay, so what this means is that if we have some error that happens on the state psi, a poly error, then originally the state has all plus 1 eigenvalues for all the generators of the stabilizer. But if this error anti-commutes with some of the generators, then it will change the eigenvalues from plus 1, for those generators, it will change them from plus 1 to minus 1. So you can immediately see that this is a good way to detect errors. And in particular, we can define the set N of S as the set of errors E such that E and M commute for all M in the stabilizer. Okay? And if E is outside N of S, then we can detect that the error E has happened by measuring the generators of the stabilizer, right? Because one of those, because E at, well, is outside N of S, it has to anti-commute with something in the stabilizer. And so some eigenvalue will switch from plus 1 to minus 1. Okay? So if we measure all the eigenvalues of all the generators, which is sufficient to tell us the eigenvalues of everything in the stabilizer, then we'll see that something has gone wrong. Okay? So questions on this yet? Yeah.
Error for the circuit. How often that do you have to check for errors? Like, do you have to do it at the
right
gate? Or?
That's kind of up to you. So we haven't talked about fault tolerance yet, and we won't really have too much time to do it. But of course, the error correction process itself is going to take some gates, right? So even if you do kind of one gate, then you do error correction immediately, there's still actually lots of gates that occur, mostly part of this error correction cycle, that before you actually get the opportunity to see whether there's been an error or not. In some sense, that's maybe the best thing to do, but you might also want to wait. And it's just a question of kind of a trade-off of how many errors you can tolerate. The thing is, you won't be able to see, because there's so many errors, there's so many gates in the error correction process itself, you won't be able to tell whether, if you see an error, whether it actually occurred on the previous gate or on one of the gates during error correction, or maybe a gate in the previous, towards the end of the previous error correction that you did. So you're not able, in the fault tolerance context, you're not able to identify exactly when these errors occur. So then it's just kind of a trade-off of how long you want to wait. I mean, if you do it more often, then you have to do more gates, because you have to do more error correction. But if you do it less often, then there's more opportunity for errors to build up. And then, you know, if too many errors build up, then you won't be able to correct them. So it's a kind of a trade-off there. But are there any? Yeah. Okay.
If we are given a stabilizer, we still have to figure out how to implement it so that
right.
we, because this way, qubit hand this way, you are actually measuring the qubits, right?
So right. So I'm not going to really talk about that. So for this set of three, you can look at the circuit that we did yesterday for the repetition code, because it's just the same thing. Okay? And if you think about it, there's actually a relatively easy generalization of that to measuring any eigenvalue of a poly, something from the poly group. But I don't want to talk about it in detail, because not enough time. You also can come up, actually it turns out for any stabilizer code, you can come up with a circuit that does the encoding, that creates these code words from, the unencoded qubits plus some zero states. The one process that is not necessarily straightforward, or not automatic really, is given the error syndrome, figuring out what error occurred. Okay? When we design codes, we like to design codes where it's relatively easy to do that. But if you just take kind of an arbitrary stabilizer code, this is a very hard problem. In fact, it's NP hard. That's not unique to stabilizer codes. It's already true of classical linear codes. So this is a problem that already occurs in classical theory of classical error correction. And it's just kind of inherited for quantum codes from the classical theory. So a lot of effort people put in classically is actually coming up with codes that have good decoding algorithms, algorithms where you can, given the error syndrome, you can figure out what the error is quickly. I don't really have too much time to say any more about that. Okay, but there are other questions on this stuff? Okay, so let me go to the next step. So there's two more steps. So first of all, if this is saying that if an error is outside the normalizing period, outside N of S, then we can detect it. But actually, the set of detectable errors is even bigger than that, because if an error is inside S, and S, I should say, is always a subset of N of S. Why is that? Well, S is abelian, right? So everything in S commutes with everything in S, and therefore that's part of the definition of N of S, right? That it commutes with everything in S. So S is always a subset of N of S. And if you have an error that's in S, well, then when it acts on a code word, it just gets back a code word, right? That's what the definition of S is. And if it doesn't actually change the code word, it's not really an error. Right? It's just acting like the identity on the code space. So when we talk about the set of detectable errors, or really the set of undetectable errors in this case, we usually are talking about the set N of S minus S. Okay. Again, anything outside N of S is detectable because it changes an eigenvalue, and anything inside S is not really an error. So it's N of S minus S is bad because these are the things will take some code word to a different code word. Okay, and that's something there's no way you can figure out, because you have no way of knowing whether the original encoded state was the first code word or the second code word after the error. Okay, so these are the things that are bad. Okay, but of course this is just a matter of detecting errors. To correct errors, we need to figure out exactly which error really did occur, not just that there's been an error. And the point is that each E will anti-commute with a different, potentially different set of stabilizer generators, right? That's the whole point of the error syndrome. The error syndrome tells us which generators this E commutes with and which ones it anti-commutes with, okay?
And so ideally, if every single different error corresponds to a different error syndrome, right, then we know exactly which error occurred and we can correct it. So what does that mean? So E and F have different error syndromes. If and only if E and F commute with different sets of generators or different subsets of the stabilizer. Okay? And what does that mean? Well, so we can rewrite this condition by looking at the product EF. Or actually, when you want to generalize beyond stabilizer codes, it makes sense to look at E dagger F. But for polys, it's the same thing. And so E dagger F will commute with M. Okay, so let's forget this if and only. So E dagger F commutes with M if and only if E and F have the same commutation relation with M. Right? So either if both of them commute with M, then this is true. If both of them anti-commute with M, this is true. Right? Because you get two minus ones. But if one of them commutes and one of them anti-commutes, then E dagger F will anti-commute with M. Okay? And so what that tells us is that in order to see if E and F have different error syndromes, we should see whether E dagger F commutes with every M in the stabilizer. In other words, E and F have different error syndromes if and only if E dagger F is not in N of S. Okay? So then we get the following theorem about stabilizer codes. So suppose we have E is a set of possible errors. And S is our stabilizer. So then S corrects E if and only if E dagger F is not in N of S minus S for all pairs, E F in E. Okay? So why is this? Well, so if E dagger F is outside N of S, then, as we said, that means that E and F have different error syndromes. So measuring the error syndrome will tell us which one we have. Okay, so that's good. What if E dagger F is in S? Well, in the same way as before, E dagger F then is not really an error, because E dagger F is in S implies that E dagger F psi is equal to psi. Right, it's in the stabilizer for all code word psi, which is the same as saying, putting the E on the other side, that F psi is equal to E psi. Okay, so these two errors, we can't tell them apart by measuring the error syndrome, but in this case we don't need to because they do the same thing to the code words. Okay, so E and F act the same and therefore can be corrected the same way. Okay? So that's why this is the right condition. On the other hand, if E dagger F is in N of S minus S, then Edagger F is an undetectable error, right? It'll take one code word to a different code word, which means that if we can't distinguish them by measuring the error syndrome, so we have to guess which error actually occurred. And if we guess wrong, you know, suppose we have the error F, but we think it's E, so we correct E, that's the E dagger, then we end up with the overall effect of E dagger F, which is something that changes one code word to a different code word. So that's bad. That's what we want to avoid. So that's why this is the sufficient and necessary condition for correcting E. Okay? So let's see. So a few other things. So if we have E dagger F inside S at some point, so if we're using this minus S condition, the code is called a degenerate. Quantum error corrected code. And if it doesn't happen, then it's a non-degenerate code. So the 9-qubit code is a degenerate code because it's supposed to correct arbitrary 1-qubit errors. So products like this should be arbitrary products of 2-qubit things. But you'll see there were some 2-qubit things in the stabilizer, Z tensor Z. I mean, I erased it, but you can look in your notes. So that means it's a degenerate code. And you can see that in the original version of the code too, right? Because if you have Z1 and Z2, they both take 000 plus 111 to 000 minus 111. They do the same thing. Okay? And this phenomenon of a code being degenerate, this doesn't occur in the theory of classical error correction. So this is something that's unique to the quantum coding theory, and it makes it more complicated, unfortunately. But it's also interesting. Okay. The other thing is we like to define something called the distance of a stabilizer code as the minimum weight of some operator n in this set of bad errors, n of s minus s. And so weight means the number of qubits where n acts non-trivially. In other words, where it's not the identity. And so that means that, for instance, if you have X tensor X tensor I tensor I, that's a weight 2 operator, right? And the point of this definition is this is the smallest bad thing. But if we want to correct errors, so for instance, if we want to correct t qubit errors, well, then any E and F in this set E, that's a set of all T qubit errors. So this product could be anything that's a product that's weight 2T, right? So if this thing has a distance that's greater than 2T, then we can correct these T qubit errors, right? Whereas if it has a distance that's less than 2T, then there's going to be, or less than or equal to 2T, then there's going to be something of weight 2T here that's bad. So if we want to correct T qubit errors, we need distance at least 2T plus 1. Yeah?
You said that if we have one of element of the TM,
right?
If we square it together, plus or minus the identity.
Right.
They are all addition, right? So.
When you have this phase of I, that can appear up front. So they could be Hermitian or another Hermitian.
How do you know that that like part on the first line, if you multiply by E on both sides, we will get F not minus F, for example?
Sorry, here?
Yeah, when you multiply by...
So first of all, that's one reason why I wrote an E dagger F, so that when you multiply by E, you really do get It's still unitary.
Okay.
They're all unitary, that's certainly true. So that's one reason why I wrote Edecker. But in practice, we don't really have to worry about the phases here. I mean, if you write E instead of E dagger, and E happens to be one of the anti-commutative ones, but then you multiply by E dagger, I need to be more careful than that. So when you define the stabilizer, I'm actually defining these elements of the polygroup. So we have to worry about the phases of the elements of the polygroup. So if you want to define a code that's a minus one eigenstate of Z tensor Z, then you can let minus Z tensor Z be part of the stabilizer. Okay? So you can start to play tricks with these eigenvalues. Let me think. So So for this particular thing, like I said, I define this E dagger F. But if you're less careful and you just say E F, that's okay here because that only makes a difference of possibly a minus sign. And this N of S is defined as the things that commute with the stabilizer. So in the stabilizer, you have to be careful about the signs. But in the normalizer, you get both signs. Because if E commutes with everything in the stabilizer, then so does minus E. Sorry, that's what I should have said. Okay. Are there other questions?
I think we might get the last statement.
This last statement. Yeah. Right, okay. Do it again. So we use a miscondition. If we want to correct T errors, T qubit errors, well, then the set E is a set of all T qubit poly errors. Okay? So we take pairs of things that could be different things in the set, and we look at the product of them. But if each of them is weight T, then the product is certainly at most weight 2T. Okay? And if this thing has nothing of weight less than 2T plus 1, then it can't be that anything of weight T is in the set. Okay? So that's the whole argument. Any other questions? Yeah?
How did we define the code word? Like, is any vector in the Hilbert space a proper code word?
We define the code words this way. So we came up with the stabilizer. And then we define code words as anything that's a joint plus one eigenstate of all the stabilizer elements. Any other questions? Okay, so
let's see. So let me just define a bit of notation then. So if we have a quantum error correcting code, or really a stabilizer code, with n physical qubits, k logical qubits, or encoded qubits, and distance d, then we write this as NKD in double brackets like this. So if you're using classical linear codes, you write them in single brackets, and the double brackets that indicate that it's a quantum code. And so this notation here captures kind of all of the most important properties of this quantum error correcting code. Okay? And so let me just do one more thing and then we'll break, which is to take advantage of this stabilizer formalism that I've shown you to write down a more efficient quantum error correcting code. So so far the only code you've seen is a 9-qubit code. It uses 9 qubits to correct one error and encode 1 qubit. You can do it with fewer than that. And in fact, the smallest quantum error correcting code
correct one error is a 513 code.
So 513, remember, means that has 5 physical qubits, 1 logical qubit, and distance 3. Distance 3 is what we need to correct one error.
So here's its stabilizer.
So as there should be 4 generators, right? Because we have 5 physical qubits and 1 logical qubit. So 5 minus 1 is 4 by this proposition. And I guess this time I've written out the whole thing, including the I. There's various other things one could say about this code. This one happens to be cyclic. Every generator is a cyclic permutation of this. There's a 5th cyclic permutation, but you don't need to write it down because it's a product of these 4. I guess the other nice thing about this code is it's every error syncrome, so it's a non-degenerate code, unlike the non-qubit code, and every error syncrome gets used, right? There's 5 qubits. You could have errors X, Y, and Z on any single qubit. That's 15 error syncrums plus 1 for the identity, so 16 error syncrums. And we have 4 generators. Each of them has 2 eigenvalues, so that's 2 to the 4, 16. So every possible error syncrome corresponds to a unique single-qubit error or zero-qubit error. So this is called a perfect code. Okay. So I think that's probably a good place to stop. For those who came in a little bit late or those who were here but were still asleep and didn't register, Freddie is sick. So he's not going to be lecturing today. I will instead give a second lecture, also on quantum information. But I guess we should take a regular 15-minute break or something, and before we start that, okay? And then tomorrow, hopefully, Freddie will be feeling better, and he will give 2 lectures. So those who are only in the quantum.